everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, one of the hosts of the channel, and each week I try to pick a book that I find particularly interesting, and I interview the author of that book. And this week I'm very pleased to say we have Audie Gordon on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, Toward Nationalism's End, an intellectual biography of Hans Kohn. I read Hans Kohn in graduate school with great fascination. I was a Russianist at the time, and he wrote a famous book on Pan-Slavism, which I read, and he seemed to be a brilliant guy. It was a big, thick book. It had tons of footnotes, and he seemed to be able to read every European language and maybe some non-European ones. I don't know, but I found him terribly impressive. And then when I saw that Audie had written his biography, I said, you know, I have to read this. So I contacted Audie and said, I'd like to interview you, which is what I'm doing now. Audie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Marshall.
Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a professor of history at Amherst College. I was born and raised in Israel. I studied in Jerusalem, Berlin, and Madison, Wisconsin. And my areas of expertise are modern Jewish history and European intellectual history. I'm particularly interested in German Jews and more accurately in Central European intellectuals. Most of my works, at least so far, looked at intersections of Central European and Jewish history and ideas and other historical arenas and the global transformations. Being an Israeli had, or still has, something to do with much of my research interests, questions about the nature and course of Jewish history or of Arab-Palestinian history matter in a very tangible way. And I was always sort of drawn to those questions. So my first book, for example, dealt with Jewish left-wing intellectuals who fled Nazi Germany to Palestine. The Zionist society in Palestine wanted to absorb them as newcomers, but they resisted and sort of clung to their German cultural identity and hence sort of experienced life in the promised land as sort of a bitter exile. And my second book dealt with interwar Zionists who rejected the idea of a Jewish nation state and advocated instead binationalism, or what we nowadays call the one state solution. So I think for many people nowadays, you know, such stories would make little sense. How can Zionists be against the Jewish state, or how can Jews from Hitler's Germany reject the Zionist society, which sort of seeks to absorb them? But those exactly, for me, are the markers of what history can tell and how it allows us to sort of see other possibilities. So that's who I am and the kind of work I do.
Well, I mean, that's a great answer, because one of the things I particularly enjoy about studying history is trying to wrap my mind around ideas that historical figures found very easy to put together, but mm-hmm. I can't at all. And you just mentioned a couple of them.
Yeah,
and I think Kohn's life
between us, right?
Yeah, I think Kohn's life sort of nicely encapsulates much of what you're talking about, because to us, he's a very strange figure because he is able to unite ideas that, again, for us, just do not go together at all. So, yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that. Why, I mean, you've kind of answered this question, but why did you write a biography of Hans Kohn?
So, you know, I first encountered Kohn not as, you know, the pioneer of study of nationalism, which he is, not as a historian of nationalism, but actually for his break with Zionism. Many years ago, I considered writing a dissertation sort of as a collective biography of Central European intellectuals who, so to speak, moved through the Zionist movement. That is to say, people who were Zionists for a while and then broke with it or just lost interest. And potentially it could also include intellectuals who lived in the Zionist society in Palestine in the 30s and 40s, but never actually became Zionist and then moved on. And, you know, the list of prominent ex-Zionist intellectuals is astonishing. It's really long. It includes names like Nathan Birnbaum, Yaakov Dehan, Arthur Koestler, Arnold Zweig, Hannah Arendt in a way, Leon Ross, and quite a few others. And what I was thinking was sort of a certain common thread in what brought them to this break with Zionism, or something common in the experience of this break, or at least something common in the later impact. But ultimately, I abandoned the project. You know, I felt that this is too disjointed for a dissertation, but I did keep Hans Kohn. Because, you know, the more I learned about Kohn, the more he fascinated me and actually sort of confused me. The pieces of his life and his career, it just didn't seem to add up. You know, as a scholar of nationalism, Kohn defined nationalism as sort of a modern construct. But in his Zionist writings, the nation was not a construct. It was a self-evident reality, a link grounded, if you will, in the blood to antiquity. Or as a scholar of nationalism, he famously distinguished between the benign civic nationalism and the malignant ethnic nationalism. But if you look at his Zionist writing, it clearly indicates that he was actually drawn precisely to this negative type of nationalism, to ethnic nationalism, to nationalism of blood and soil, or at least the myth of blood and soil. And then I continued reading, and there were more and more things that just did not add up. You know, there was an impressive career as a pacifist, but also a career as a cold warrior, very serious about revolutionary socialism at one stage of his life, but then, you know, very close to the Austrian School of Economics in a later stage. At one point, he sort of vilifies America, the U.S., and in another stage, he idealizes. And, you know, in other words, I saw a series of dramatic ideological conversions at the heart of Kohn's biography, which both informed and were informed by his evolving theory of nationalism.
Yeah.
So interestingly, you know, whatever political stance Kohn presented at a given time, he always did so as, you know, the great authority on nationalism. And his biography, I think, that demonstrates how virtually all political ideologies of the 20th century theorized nationalism in order to legitimize themselves, legitimize their claim. And I would like to say also that there's yet another thing that we learn from those ideological conversions, from Kohn's ideological conversions. I came to see in him sort of a lifelong struggle with nationalism, which he tried to tame by analyzing it, by framing nationalism, by defining it, by giving the theory. And the catastrophes of the 20th century, which surprised him like all others again and again, repeatedly shattered his worldview and forced him to re-theorize nationalism. But I guess the point is that his is not a story of a man who, with each crisis, comes, as it were, closer to a fuller understanding of what nationalism is, its history, its future. Rather, Kohn's story is a story of non-arrival. You know, as a very old man, regardless of what his published work proclaimed, Kohn expressed as much doubt and confusion about the future of nationalism and about his own political allegiances as he did as a young adult. So Kohn's non-arrival, however, I think it's important because it's inherent to the questions raised by nationalism, whose context, impact, and historical context is ever-changing. So, you know, so I began looking into Kohn as through his break with Zionism, but what emerged was an entirely different book. And apart from being sort of a book which is also about Jewish history, Zionist history, or about intellectuals in politics, it became, I think, first and foremost, a book about nationalism, you know, studying a man who very prominently formulated very different theories about nationalism at different times. This is a book about the changing perspective on nationalism. I think it provides sort of historical perspective on how nationalism is experienced and understood. And in this regard, it allows us to sort of critically reflect on how we understand nationalism, how we understand the essence of nationalism, the history of nationalism, and its future. Mm-hmm. That's it in a nutshell.
Well, that was a good nutshell. And I think I said this to you in an email. One of the things that makes Cohen and makes your book really good, one of the things that makes Cohen really interesting is he was the rare kind of intellectual who was willing to change his mind. And he did it a lot. Mm-hmm. He was not willing simply to say, okay, I have discovered the truth. Here it is with a capital T, and I'm going to stick with it no matter what, because he doesn't do that at all. When he's baffled, he more or less says so and changes his mind.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I want to say, Marshall, that, you know, the interesting thing is you have quite a few ideological converts in the history books, but they appear to come in different types. There are the ones who are the bridge burners, like, you uh-huh. know, Arthur Koestler, who prides himself on saying, you know, I am totally different. I see it entirely differently. I used to be a communist, and I'm an anti-communist.
Yeah, that would be the kind of conversion experience that they have.
Right. Yeah. There's a certain pride in it. With Cohen, it's a bit different. I think he changes all the time, but continually he claims, you know, as I said before, so and so. Like, he doesn't proclaim his ideological conversions, but conversion, but rather present himself as a overall consistent thinker. So I, in a way, in order to analyze him, I really had to read him against his own grain.
I see just what you mean. I do. Well, let's get into his life. He was born and raised in Prague. This is a fascinating part of the book because, on the one hand, I was amazed how assimilated the Jews of Prague were, but not in the way we usually think about it, that he was thinking like a Habsburg. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think the Habsburg setting of his childhood, or the Habsburg-Prague setting of his childhood, is sort of formative, at least if we think of it, of his biography as a biography of the scholar of nationalism, in two ways. One is just the fact that he grew up in a multinational, multi-ethnic city where Jews, Germans, Czechs still lived side by side. And that was experienced in at least two ways. One is the omnipresence of the national conflict between German nationalists and Czech nationalists he at least later in his life came to be very critical of, and I would claim that also in a younger age was in equal measures both impressed by it and not oppressed at all. So that is the one context. And I think, you know, if we situate Cohen's childhood or begin the trajectory of his life as a scholar of nationalism from this point, it's not only the conflict, but also the various Habsburg plans for dealing with it, the different architectures, if you will, political architectures that were presented at the time. So one that was very formative was the concept of nationalism of the Austro-Marxists, basically saw the Habsburg monarchy transformed into a truly multinational federation. And also saw the idea of extraterritorial autonomies, national autonomies, in a way offering a path for political modernity, which is dramatically different than the nation state. But, you know, Cohen at the time was not really thinking those terms. So that's just things that he was exposed to. Now, there's another dimension of his Habsburg-Prague childhood that you alluded to in your question, that namely of his Jewishness. So, as you mentioned, it was, in his terms, a highly assimilated Jewish household that he was born in and raised in, where, you know, Jewishness was a sort of a social reality. The friends and the colleagues and many of the neighbors were Jewish, but there was nothing sort of, I would say, positive about there was no positively defined Jewishness, or hardly any positively defined Jewishness in his setting. That is to say, he did not receive any Jewish education, had virtually no Jewish knowledge as a, you know, as in middle school or even high school, nor did he suffer from anti-Semitism in a very clear way. And so what we have on the whole is very minimal, almost insignificant Jewishness, which is in a way the starting point, but brings us to a next stage in his life, still in pre-war Habsburg Prague, in the summer of 1908, when he suddenly becomes a Zionist. Suddenly he joins the Zionist Student Association, Bar Kokhba. He is 17 at the time. And this sort of became his world for the next years. So the interesting thing is, like, you know, if we mentioned that Jewishness or his Jewishness at the time was virtually insignificant, that project was, as it were, to turn it precisely to something significant indeed in their life. And there's a sort of an element of a generational rebellion in this regard, against the Jewish worldview of the parents' generation. So as members of Bar Kokhba Zionist Student Association, the main drive underlining that Zionism was a quest for authentic identities. We're born out of a sense that the Jewish identity was either inauthentic or perceived as inauthentic. And now Konev and his friends presented their Jewishness first and foremost as nationality, comparable to that of the Czechs and the Germans in many regards. And at the same time, he and his friends were especially fascinated by the idea of a nationality grounded in blood and in soil and in quite a few other benchmarks or hallmarks of ostensible hallmarks of bona fide nationalism, that is to say, a national language, national territory, shared national history. That's very interesting in multiple ways. First of all, and I don't want to mention this too early, he will change his mind dramatically regarding this. But second of all, he and his friends knew from the get-go that this concept of nationalism is imported from without and does not really apply or fit neatly the reality of the Jews that they knew around them.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to mention this exactly, if I could just break in for a second, because his nationalism is, I'm trying to think of the right word for it, but it's particularly idealistic in the sense that it is not rooted in any scriptural tradition. This is a guy that knew nothing about Judaism per se. And it's not really even reflected in his experience, because he knew there were lots of kinds of assimilated Jews and unassimilated Jews. Mm-hmm. So there doesn't seem to be anything holding. There's not even a common language community, you know, to sort of talk about. One of the benchmarks is that, you know, Jews were speaking lots of different languages. They were scattered all over Europe and other places. So this was a really very notional kind of nation. It was just a nation of the mind, you know?
No, in many ways, yes, indeed. I mean, one thing, of course, is that, you know, we tend to imagine nationalism as a movement of self-affirmation. We just want that which we are to continue be perpetuated, but that is not the case for Zionism, largely, but particularly to that kind of Zionism, which sort of imagined itself anew. There's an interesting process of self-exotization, self-orientalization, and I think precisely because this process takes a leap. Of not a leap of faith, but so as much as it's an act of imagination. Very limited Jewish knowledge actually was proved to be very fruitful and very effective. Their project was to go to Jewish history and make it their own, and in a way they were freer to do so because it was more radical. Right. It was not atheism. Right. It was not that which their parents did, but there was something almost subversive, if you will, about it.
No, I see just what you mean. And, you know, I mean, it's like they were trying to create the new Jewish man, the sort of the equivalent of the new socialist man. And they didn't really have a great idea what this was going to be like. And it was just somehow going to appear in a weirdly romantic kind of evolutionary way. I find it very fascinating because it's very foreign to to draw a weird analogy. It's a little bit like thinking about being an American. Like, what exactly is that? Because there's so many kinds of Americans, and you know, people talk about American nationalism, and I was like, what could that possibly be? You know, we're just so different. And Eastern European Jewry, or Central European Jewry, was extraordinarily diverse at the time. Like,
The fact that this is a nationalism grounded not on demographic, political, linguistic reality, but it's on its negation, turn Zion, if you will, into a perfect ideal that, in a way, looking from the whole span of his life, could never be achieved, right? The moment you try to fulfill and to realize that, you will be disillusioned because it's so divorced from reality and actually defined and imagined in negation to it. Now, I would like to qualify it a little bit. You know, it's true that they were drawn to those ideas of blood and national blood, national soil, national language, but there was actually an ambivalence throughout. And that was, for me, one of the most interesting and confusing parts of writing the book, because you do want to have a sort of a clearer sense of what, you know, how did they, at that, if you will, embryonic stage, theorize nationalism? How did they understand it? And I came to the conclusion that throughout, they are both, you know, cognitively, they know it doesn't apply. And they even know that it's a bit dangerous. And in a way, this is why they're drawn to it. But at the very same time, the appeal is so great. And it's constantly there. So, you know, in the chapter of the pre-war years, you can see quite a few essays that they write, because that's what those Zionists do at the time. They primarily write and write in German about the blood, the mystique of the blood, the importance of the blood, the idea of a primordial trait, which are beyond, you know, one's decisions, and even beyond our awareness. It's some sort of subconsciously there. It's sort of an idea that attracted them in a great way. And but in those very issues, the very next stage, they would write against racism. So how come race is bad and blood is good? It's something that they had to struggle with, and it was the same applies to the idea of land and territory.
Right. Yeah. No, it's very fraught. So let's move forward a little bit in his life. And so he has an unexpected turn of events. He ends up, if I recall correctly, captured by Russians. He in World War I, right? I mean, how does he get there?
Yes. So World War I, first of all, you know, World War I really changed his life. Like it changed many of the people of his generation, which is the generation of 1914, the generation of the war. And in a bit, I will say in what way it changed it. But there's just a progression of events. When the war broke out, he actually saw in it a great opportunity. He was, I'm not exaggerating, enthusiastic about the war, the possibilities that he ostensibly opened. And he saw it in many ways as a Jewish war of liberation. He wrote those poems and has somewhat jingoistic letters from the time in which he described how the war would revolutionize the Jewish world. And he was not alone in this sense. There were quite a few Jews of that generation throughout Europe and in a way throughout the world who facing the dilemma of the outbreak of World War I, conceptualized scenarios in which this actually could be a blessing in disguise for the Jews, or so they hoped. So one of the classic ideas was the liberation of the Jews of the Romanov Empire, of the Tsarist pogromist yoke, as they called it at the time. So he volunteered. Not only did he volunteer, he went to officer. He was an officer cadet, an officer school. And after sort of long training, he went to the front, volunteered to the front in March of 1915. And I'm assuming, I read his notes very carefully, I'm assuming that the first time that he saw battle was also the day and the moment that he was captured by the Russians. And he was captured by the Russians so all throughout the war and actually beyond it. So he was captured, as mentioned, in March of 1915, but remained a prisoner of war until the end of the war. And then he was trapped in the Russian civil war. And could not return home until 1920. And it's not a very exceptional case that happened to quite a few prisoners of war in the context of the Russian Civil War. As a POW in the Russian Far East, he witnessed for the very first time colonialism, and it left a very deep impact on him. And it became evident to him that a colonial setting gives nationalism an entirely different meaning, one that he would soon reflect on in his writings about Zionism and nationalism in general. But a few other things happened during this time that also shaped him. So first and foremost, he witnesses the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, his own country disintegrating into its national component. So the situation is, he is a prisoner of war of a country that no longer exists in a war that already ended. Another thing that emerges is this the rise of the nation state model, and of course definitely applies first and foremost to what used to be the Austro-Hungarian Empire, when the national components now demand a nation state each. In those years of the POW, it was then that Kohn actually wrote his first systematic studies of nationalism, which already presented sort of an interesting dichotomy of sorts between two types of nationalism. At the time, he distinguishes between true nationalism, which is essentially spiritual self-affirmation, and what he calls the objectionable ideology of the nation state on the other. Right. So what we can see here is someone who's seeing the impact of nationalism on a continental scale, and tries to contain it by defining what nationalism is in a slightly different manner. So it's, from here on out, for quite a few years, he has this idea of political nationalism and cultural nationalism on the other. Right? This idea of cultural self-affirmation as the true face of nationalism. Mm-hmm. I can say a few more things about what else he does in those years, but maybe more importantly, he sees those years as the most decisive years of his life. You know, mm-hmm. They politicize him. So if you think about his Zionism earlier on, his nationalism earlier on, entirely not addressing any questions of international relations, the state, you know, things along those lines. But it was sort of an inward-looking, not only cultural, but actually sort of spiritual nationalism focused on the dilemmas of the individual. So now his he is politicized. His nationalism is politicized. He understands, he thinks about nationalism in entirely a different context. The idea of a socialist revolution, it raises, and especially the early Soviet nationalities policies pose a major challenge for him, and he, as we'll talk pretty soon, very much admires those in the earlier stages. he becomes sensitized to the significance of colonialism, and most clearly, he becomes a staunch opponent of the nation-state model, and that pretty much defines his 1920s, the decade that comes thereafter.
Mm-hmm. So he does work. He essentially becomes a professional Zionist at this point, or something close to it, doesn't he? After his release in he was freed in 1920. Is that right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. 1920. But at that point, he goes and works for, I don't remember the names of these organizations, but he works for international Zionist organizations. Yeah.
Yeah, he does. He does. I mean, I guess, first and foremost, he is entirely committed to Zionism as of 1908. It really was mm-hmm. his world. And it's an interesting thing, you know, if I'm staying a little bit in the years of captivity before he comes back home, on a emotional level, I wouldn't say psychological, but an emotional level, there's something very interesting happening. You know, he loses, at the moment that he loses his freedom, his agency, he challenges all of his energies, direct all of his energies in two related ways. First and foremost, he uses those years as years of self-education. And since it's World War One and not World War Two, actually he receives through the Red Cross quite a few parcels and has a lot of free time on his hand. And he actually teaches himself Arabic, Persian, works on his other foreign languages, primarily works on Russian, reads extensively. I mean, most of his letters from those years relate to his reading and education on multiple fields. But as mentioned, also about the question of nationalism, it emerges gradually as the focal point, trying to understand what nationalism is.
This is one of the, if I could just interrupt for a second, this is what was one of the things that reminded me of how different the world was in World War One than it was from World War Two, because he really was given a lot of free time, and he had books, and they didn't actually treat him that badly. It reminds me that when Lenin first got shipped into Siberian exile, the Tsarist authorities made sure that they sent his library with him.
Yeah, I know.
It was a different world.
First of all, it was definitely very much a different world compared to World War II, where we know how it would have ended and how briefly.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's also a world of various classes. So the fact that he was an officer cadet, his life as a prisoner of war was very much very different than that of the other, you know, GIs. Mm-hmm. At the time. So as said, you know, he directs all of his energies in a way, sort of he escapes to the realm of the mind in his studies of languages and essentially early studies of nationalism. But the other part is when he, at the later stage, after the first Russian Revolution, he... there's an improvement in the conditions of the POWs, at least for a while. And he uses this new liberty to create somewhat of a POW college and a Zionist POW college. So all that knowledge that he absorbed and all those patterns of, you know, intellectual dispute that he has known from his years as a Zionist in Prague, he... now project out to his fellow POWs in an activity which is very much a continuation of Bar Kokhba. As a matter of fact, he publishes with them a periodical of those POWs, which is actually quite interesting and high level. And the name of that periodical is From Judentum, On Judaism, which is the title of the book that he edited in 1913 for Bar Kokhba. So, going back to your original question, already before he returns home from captivity, he's very much committed to working in the Zionist organizations and reaches out to many of his colleagues asking about it. And indeed, when he comes back, he serves in the first in Paris in the Comité de Délégation Juive, which is sort of the representative of Jewish delegations to the peace talks in Paris. which is an interesting peace conference, and it's an interesting case because, of course, that also relates to the vision of a world of nation states in the Wilsonian moment. But those Jewish representatives are the ones who were most central in advocating minority rights. Right, uh-huh. Which is in a way is the backyard of the world of nation state, a sort of a corrective to the world of the nation state. However, for various reasons, I would not go into it. He does not identify with this institution at all for what he sees as half measures. And then he continues to London, where he becomes the head of the Department of Propaganda of Keren Hayesod, which is sort of a Zionist organization's main fundraising, if you will, institution, to put it bluntly. It's not an accurate definition. And in this capacity, he stays for essentially until his break from Zionism. There is an interesting tension in the 1920s between his position as a salaried bureaucrat of the Zionist organization and his very radical statement against Zionist policy. Right? There's an interesting tension over there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. And that already sort of brings us clearly, neatly to his post-captivity, the return to Europe, and then his move to Palestine. So in the 1920s, largely...
And he goes to Palestine in 1925, is that right?
Yeah, so basically...
Sometime, yeah.
So if I'll chart the map, he returns from Russian captivity in 1920, stays for about a year in Paris, then moves in 21 or 22 to London, where he stays until 1925, when he moves to Palestine together with the office in which he served. So
yeah,
this is the point in which he moves to Palestine. So he comes, as mentioned, as a salaried functionary, Zionist functionary, Zionist bureaucrat, but he does a few other things parallel to that. And those are actually more dominant and more crucial in framing his career, or actually careers in the plural, in the 1920s and even early 30s. So he publishes quite extensively on Jewish thought. He is Middle East correspondent for German-speaking periodicals like the Neue Zürcher Zeitung and the Frankfurter Zeitung. He, more importantly, is an aspiring scholar of the modern Middle East, or the modern East, and particularly of nationalism in the Middle East. And he is also co-founder of Binational Zionism. So all of those arenas are worthy of elaboration. One thing that they all have in common is that they all are informed by his negation of the nation-state model. So let me maybe focus on, first and foremost, about his binational Zionism.
Can I ask a question before you do?
Mm-hmm.
Binational Zionism? And this is just a curiosity, and I just am trying to imagine what it must have been like to be Hans Cohn in Palestine in 1926. What language did he speak to people in? I mean, I'm just trying to think, because he must have been surrounded by some Zionists who actually were religious as well. And he must have also been surrounded by people who, Jews who had been in Palestine forever.
Yeah.
No. And it must have been a crazy scene.
So lucky for Hans Cohn, he was a polyglot. He knew quite a few languages. He actually lectured in Hebrew when in Palestine, he lectured in Russian, when in Russian activities, he published in French, and of course, German, and a good command of Czech.
Wow.
But the most important language in his life until, or at least I would say from his childhood throughout his years in Palestine, was German. That was the language that was spoken in his household. That was the language that he spoke to most of his interlocutors and his peers. That was the language that he published in as a scholar. English grew also in significance in the Palestine years because, of course, this all happened under the British mandatory rule.
I was just interested in the kind of cultural milieu because it sounds absolutely fascinating in its diversity.
So
I just can't imagine what it was like to be there.
It is a fascinating one. You know, there is a certain core of it, which is certainly Central European France, Central European Jews. They can come from Prague or Berlin. But if you look, for example, at the binational Zionists, the most dominant group among them are Central European Jews or German-speaking Jews, some of them friends that he had even before he moved to Palestine. But that's not the whole picture, right? There were also Eastern European Jews, Jews from the States, like Judeo-Magnus, quite a few others. I guess the interesting thing is that it's not only the small marginal group of like-minded intellectuals around Cohen that is interesting, but I think the society, the Jewish society in Palestine, the Zionist society at the time, it's fascinating, right? Yeah. We're talking about here a small immigrant society, extremely young, really young. You know, so many of them are young adults or even younger than that. It is the create a society and a culture and an identity for themselves in a different continent, away from Europe, and sort of imagining themselves anew. And I think this definitely appeals to Cohen even after his aforementioned break with Zionism. This is something.
Well, I could kind of imagine it did, because in a sense, what it was nationalism as an idea and not as an ethnicity, because these people were ethnically very different. But they were all somehow Zionists.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I mean, they definitely came from different languages and different backgrounds. I mean, so that side of it was definitely very appealing for him. But of course, you know, he and many of his colleagues were increasingly concerned about where this heads, where this with its leads. So just to give sort of a general picture of what he does in the 20s, I mentioned that he begins to write as a scholar, not yet fully as a scholar of nationalism writ large, a general scholar of nationalism, but particularly of nationalism in the Middle East. And he writes actually with a great degree of identification. And you can see how the various things sort of merge. On the one hand, he presents a trajectory of a future, a historical trajectory of Arab nationalism or nationalism in the Middle East that does not necessarily point towards the creation of new nation states. And there's always the option of some multinational federation. And you can see how when he writes, he also writes for fellow Zionists. So there's it's very easy to draw parallels between the history of Zionism, which he also writes in those years, and the history of Arab nationalism or Middle Eastern nationalism writ large. I guess there's one more field that I should mention of his activity in the 1920s, which is interesting, and I discovered relatively late into this project, is the fact that Cohen was quite central in international pacifism in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And that too is related to his negation of the nation-state model and sort of an understanding that in order for pacifism to be effective, it has to not just talk about slogans, but really think about international relations and have sort of a viable alternative or a political, a broad strategy grounded in an understanding of nation-state dynamics, basically seeing the the nation states model as the cradle of future wars.
Right. You did mention earlier, and I don't want to leave this portion of the conversation out, you mentioned this concept of binational Zionism. Again, here's one of these things that those just don't go together for me very well. What is that thing?
So binational Zionism is an ideology of certain Zionists who believe that the proper realization of Zionism, the creation of a Jewish nation or home in Palestine, or Jewish national revival, is best realized in not in the creation of a Jewish nation state in Palestine, or the creation of Palestine as a Jewish nation state, but in the creation, which are, the two are different, right? But in the creation of a, some kind of a federation or a confederation with complete political equality for Arabs and Jews. And I want to explain, you know, how they even come to this idea. So there are multiple routes to that. On the one hand, you know, we can definitely see how when Cohn and other formulated this vision of a binational Palestine, they leaned on thoughts of Austro-Marxist and other Habsburg political thinkers and adopted and tried to apply a few of their concepts. We can also see how that relates to a nationalism or to a Zionism, which never thought of itself as purely political, but focused on a cultural revival, a national revival, was more like inward looking. But I think the most crucial element, and I've grown to understand this and accept it increasingly, is the realization of Cohn, but not only of him, of his, but also of quite a few other binationalists, that whether the Zionists wanted it or not, Zionism is taking place in a colonial setting, and the relation between the Zionist settlers and the Palestinian Arabs is the relation between the colonizer and the colonized, regardless if Zionists wanted it, regardless if Zionists are even aware of it. And since they assumed that the age of colonialism is on its way out sooner or later, building a Jewish nation state on such premises endangers the entire Zionist project. So the only way out for them was the idea of complete political parity, not a state in which there's a dominant nation, one dominant nation, and another group that is defined ipso facto as a minority. So in this regard, it doesn't even matter the size and the borders of that Jewish state. It could be as tiny as Tel Aviv, and still for them, it would be faulty and it would be a colonialist project. Right. So that is yet another important element of why they went there. So, you know, Cohn, as far as I know, is the first person to advocate clearly the path of a binational Palestine. I mean, some people spoke about it in vague terms, but he, I think, in 1919, so before he returned from Russia, already proclaimed that once a state would be established in Palestine, it would not be a nation state for long, but eventually it would become a multinational or a binational state. And we have to understand it and plan our politics and our strategy accordingly. Mm-hmm. But the idea lived on. It lived on in, you know, in the 1920s, 1926, 25, 26. He co-founded an organization called Brit Shalom, Covenant of Peace, which is a formal organization advocating binational Zionism. And there are quite a few prominent Zionist activists over there. Some of them really important in the Zionist movement. There are definitely quite a few Central European intellectuals there. He definitely is not the only one. And obviously the binational national Zionists do not have a great success in changing the minds of fellow Zionists in the 20s, nor of convincing the Palestinian Arabs to join them in this shared endeavor, not even in convincing the British that this is a path that they should necessarily take. So largely you can see it as a story of a failure, but the binational ID emerges again and again, and arguably would continue to emerge again and again as long as the Zionist-Arab conflict is not resolved. So it emerges again in the 30s and in the 40s, and there were people who, even after the establishment of the State of Israel, still were committed to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Not so for Cohn, as you know, and that maybe even brings us to the next chapter in his life.
Then he leaves Palestine, correct?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Yeah, so exactly why he left.
So it was a slow and painful break with Zionism, and he was sort of full of doubts as of the first half of the 20s, but increasingly in the late 20s in his life in Palestine. So he experiences, you know, some of the uglier manifestation of the national conflict. But also on an sort of ideological level, he loses faith. He loses faith in the feasibility of binational Zionism. He begins to think that it actually is counterproductive, and rather than convincing any Zionist or Arab nationalist or British official to move towards that path, it actually serves as a fig leaf, as a propaganda facade against its will, basically covering up or giving a wrong impression of what Zionist policies at the time are, and presenting it as Zionism, which is more dovish than it actually was. He also thought that it actually, rather than convincing fellow Zionists, creates a greater anger and right-wing radicalization or militarist radicalization against the ineffective binationalists. And there are a few endeavors in his life in the late 20s that sort of are tangled with his crisis with binational Zionism, with Zionism writ large. One of them, I would argue, is him writing the biography of his great Zionist mentor, teacher, Martin Buber, philosopher Martin Buber. And it's a biography, it begins the biography written by a disciple, but he becomes increasingly critical of Buber, and that sort of gives him a possibility of thinking in new and more critically about what he has done, his own life. So in private letters, he always calls it not Buber's biography, but his own, that is Cohn's autobiography.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also the struggle with pacifism that he increasingly realizes that this does not meet as well as his work on Arab nationalism also brings him to be more critical, not so much of the Zionists, of his fellow Zionists, but actually of Arab nationalism and the prospect of actually having a peace, the possibility of having an actual peace agreement with the other side, or ever appeasing their needs. So all of those things together bring him to the point that he further radicalizes his positions. He publishes a few articles as a German language correspondent to the Middle East about Zionism that provoked the ire of many of his fellow Zionists. And the fact that he's a salaried functionary of the Zionist organization, they force his dismissal. But before they do that, he does the classic move of saying, you know what, I quit. But that is very publicly. Many letters, public letters, and in those days, everything was in so many carbon copies. His superiors about why the gig is out, why Zionism would never work. And interestingly enough, he slams the door on Zionism, but frankly has nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And that happens in late 1929. In the immediate wake of the Palestinian Arab riots in the summer of 1929, when it becomes evident to him that Zionism could never aspire to be anything but the creation of a Jewish nation state in Palestine, and that it has to go through an inevitable, bloody, and long conflict with the Arab-Palestinian national movement. So after he makes all those proclamations, he now needs to go somewhere and find something to do. And that he's stuck in limbo for quite a few years until the spring of 1934, when he lands in a position or is invited to serve as a professor of history at Smith College, Northampton. Right
down the street from where I live.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm. That must have been quite a shock for him to show up in Western Massachusetts, sleepy Western Massachusetts, girls' school.
It was. It definitely was. You know, on the one hand, the years leading up to this were nerve-wracking because he had a wife and a child that he needed to support. He was in his early 40s, had no job prospect in the horizon, and he at many times doubted that he would ever get a position anywhere. Now, he would have probably considered teaching also in Germany, but if you know the years, it's already 1933. Even his work as a correspondent to German publications is being limited, and that's sort of another drama. So at the background of him moving to Northampton, to his new life in the New England setting, the background is his break with Zionism and the rise of Nazism, or more broadly fascism in Europe, the growing crisis in Europe. So as mentioned, at the age of 43, he leaves Palestine for good to become professor at Smith. The move to the U.S., as mentioned, was coincides also with the consolidation of Nazi rule over Germany, and also his academic breakthrough in the States occurs during World War II with his 1944 magnum opus, the idea of nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
So many things change over there. We can address them one by one, but maybe if I focus on his scholarship and his career first.
Yeah, I think that's the best idea.
So first of all, you know, up until that point, he was primarily a scholar of the modern Middle East. He moves to Smith as a Europeanist, and that very much shapes his work on nationalism. Throughout this period, he becomes, you know, also before he left Palestine, his work was increasingly addressing nationalism more broadly, the history of nationalism more broadly. But now he becomes sort of an authority in the field. And the context in which he wrote, the change in the context is crucial. So Nazism transformed the nature and purpose of discussions about the essence of nationalism. If people in the 1920s wrote about nationalism addressing primarily the question of self-determination and things along those lines, now the question was fascism and Nazism. And the question, you know, that Cohn's readers would ask is, why did German nationalism deteriorate to Nazism?
Mm-hmm.
And whether all nationalism had a similar potential, similar propensity of becoming fascism. And Cohn's response was his familiar distinction between ethnic and civic nationalism, which dominated his writing henceforth. Only civic nationalism, he would assert, retained some kind of a universal horizon, an innate propensity to always form federations or unions greater than itself. I should say, as far as the theory of nationalism is concerned, you can see, if you remember, when we talked about the 1920s, he had this notion that he had this dichotomy of true nationalism on the one end, which was somehow not political, was cultural self-affirmation, and then there was the political nationalism, which aspires to the creation of a nation state. With his break with Zionism, this collapsed. This theory collapses, and he basically thinks that in this time, the only relevant category of nationalism is political in one shape or form. And precisely because nationalism is dangerous, or has a dangerous potential, it's important to distinguish between different kinds of political nationalism. And that here comes the distinction between the civic and ethnic nationalism. I should also maybe mention another contribution that he made to the study of nationalism roughly around that time, in the 30s, and that is the definition of nationalism as a modern construct. So historicizing nationalism, saying that nationalism began at a certain moment, and insinuating, sometimes saying more clearly, that if it had a beginning, it will also have an end. Right? It's a historical phenomenon that begins at some point and frame in the modern age and would end, he always hoped, just around the corner. And the way it would end, just to connect the two pieces, the distinction between civic and the ethnic, and the idea of the constructed modernity of nationalism, is through civic nationalism, which would transcend itself. Right? It would always create greater unions. So the greater unions could be the UN, or it could be a European integration, or what have you. But the idea is that that is the path of modernity, and what happens is that in those voluntary unions, also the nation states would give up some of the sovereignty in order to create sort of a greater union. And the philosophical telos of this is the creating of a world republic. But that is the end of time. Right.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, if I could just ask a quick question about this, on a casual reading, or I guess after thinking about it a little bit, it seems to me that his civic nationalism isn't very nationalistic. You see what I mean? And it maybe exists in one place, and that's the United States, where we have this idea that we are all kind of Americans, but we're all different. The thing that holds us together is this political compact, and that kind of means we're a nation, but not really, not like Germans or something, or even Czechs or Russians or Chinese. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I do. A couple of things. So first of all, there's definitely a strong normative element, and I would even say moralistic element in his writing. Even though he didn't necessarily say so, he obviously did not like nationalism. Nationalism was a threat. I mean, it's a crucial thing because, I've done some reading of other theoreticians and historians of nationalism. And, they can be very critical and say it's all constructed, but at the end of the day, they say, no, I do like it. It appeals to me. I can see how it means for positive things. I think for him, it's sort of the realization that whether you want it or not, this is the world around you, and you have to harness it to a higher end. So I think part of the meaning of the book's name is towards nationalism's end, that is to say, making nationalism not only about the fact that nationalism has an end, a finite point, but rather that it could serve a higher end. And for him, I think the idea was, and in some regards, it's sort of similar to Marx's thoughts on capitalism. You have to let it sort of transcend itself. And there's a positive and a negative way of going about it. But he accepts it largely as part of modernization. Now, throughout his life, he identifies this civic nationalism in different places, you know. So when he's just, you know, begins to think about the possibility of civic nationalism as a positive thing, you can see that in the way he idealizes the idea of nationhood in Judaism, in a book that he writes in the mid-1920s called The Political Idea of Zionism, which is all based on the covenant.
Yeah.
But this is not really spelled out, but it's sort of embryonically.
Yeah, that's kind of like the United States without the United States, if you see what I mean.
Right.
Jews were like totally. Americans without America.
Yeah.
You know, it's called the Constitution. And, you know, like, Jews have, you know, what Moses brought down from the mountain, and that holds us all together. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So, but, you know, since you mentioned American nationalism in the States, now, of course, in 1957, he writes a similarly idealizing book called American Nationalism.
Yeah, this was my question. I was wondering what he thought about the United States, and please talk about it. It's fascinating.
All the things that you've mentioned, that, you know, that here you really have nationalism, which is not defined by blood, and of course, he integrates frontier theory into it, so it's also not really by soil. But there's so many contradictions over there, and I think the most important thing is to, if I fast forward to the end of his life, and I think this is something that I am lucky enough to be the first to point out, he was disillusioned with that as well. And at the end,
of course, he was.
During the Vietnam years, he writes very clearly, as far as the Native Americans and the African Americans, American nationalism was always and remained colonial. Strong words.
Right. Well, I mean, he went to Palestine. He found Jewish imperialism, and then he comes to the United States and he finds European imperialism.
Yeah,
kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I know. So that is, I wrote a biography without a hand.
He's not wrong about those things.
No. It's interesting, right? So
he's
constantly wrong about some things and right about others. But what you certainly cannot see in his life is a set, unchanging theory of nationalism that applies throughout that. If you've not that, then...
Let me just break in and say, because we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask this question, because this is how I really learned about him. Is he becomes, I don't want to say he's a cold warrior, but he starts to write about Russian stuff, and he seems to be very involved in this 1950s 1960 effort to kind of understand the Soviet Union in terms of, you know, the legacy of Russian nationalism, is that the word? No, Russian imperial.
Nationalism is, he would say nationalism is very true.
How does he come to do these things? He knows Russian because he learned it in a prison camp where he did a lot of reading. So how does he become involved as a cold warrior?
So first of all, I have no problem calling him a cold warrior. I really think that is what he was. He becomes a cold warrior. That's a process of his sort of what I call the catastrophic Americanization. He comes to U.S. is initially very critical of the U.S., but when things get really thorny and dangerous with the international crisis of the late 30s, he and a few other European emigres become very vocal as anti-isolationists. And they go to fellow Americans, and they themselves are not Americans at the time, but they go to Americans and tell them, this is not what we can do much better than this. And we have to, basically give them an idealized version of American values. And when America actually enters the war, that clicks. That is sort of, in many regards, a harmonious moment in his life where you have a strong policy that he feels lived up to his expectations. And he definitely believed along the line of sort of Henry Luce in the American century and in America's role in leading post colonial national movement around the world as being a force of greater liberation and a sort of fraternity of equal nations that would eventually lead to the creations of those greater unions. He's entirely, he gladly volunteers to activities for the, he's a founding member of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, goes regularly to lecture to Germans and Austrians on behalf of the United States, and as we know, sponsored by the CIA. And he's very much a Cold Warrior, works with the likes of the young Henry Kissinger and a few others. At the time, as far as the Soviet Union and the question of colonialism or imperialism, it is very important for him, as a Cold Warrior at the time, to expose what he thinks is Soviet anti-colonial posturing, and. His claim at Pan-Slavism, of course, is that behind this idea of fraternity of Slavic nations, there is a great German, sorry, great Russian, yes. Important correction, great Russian nationalism, which demands to subordinate fellow Slavic nations. So for him, it's continental imperialism. And in this regard, it's very similar to Hannah Arendt, who writes around that time about the Soviet Union in a similar fashion. So that's what brings him over there. And I don't think he is, I mean, he's a, there's a Cold War idealism in him, but I don't think that he's ever, it's not that there's no naivety in him. I don't think he ever does it cynically. So I think he really does believe in the promise of the U.S. and of NATO. For him, the creation of NATO is one step towards those, that kind of greater unions and the limitation of national sovereignty.
But if we could just, you know, to sum up for a second his life, if I could try to put a capstone on this, because we're almost out of time and I want to ask you one more question. He seems like the kind of person who thinks very deeply about things, comes to conclusion, a very affirmative one, this is the way things are, and then almost through lived experience, whatever conclusion he reaches gets kind of dashed upon the rocks of reality, and he comes to reject it. I mean, like, this business of the United States is so typical, because there it is. He found his place that was kind of post-national, that was civic nationalism, right? And it was anti-colonial. These are two things he just loves, right? And here he is. He's found it. His great cause. He makes good. And then the Vietnam War. Like, and he can't ignore it. There it is. America acting like a nation, and not only that, an imperialist one.
Right, but isn't that life and history, right?
That that's what I say. I really admire him in that way. You know, he's not willing to just say, oh, this is an aberration or something, you know, and my theory is still correct. He's just like, well, that's that.
Hans Kohn is a brilliant thinker who made multiple, or maybe all the possible mistakes in a single lifetime.
That's a great thing.
and I think, you know, maybe this, more than anything else, is what we can learn from him. Also, maybe first and foremost, not about life in general and you know, political decisions or things of that nature, but about nationalism, how nationalism changes and the essence of context of nationalism changes. So the need to theorize nationalism is understandable and is important and is crucial.
And it is evolving, you know, because even in my own lifetime, suddenly I read in the press about this thing in the United States called white nationalism.
Right.
And I never heard of such a thing in my whole life. It's just all of a sudden it appeared out of nowhere that there was this thing. And I just, it never occurred to me that there was such a thing. I don't think there really was, but it's kind of been invented. You're like seeing it be invented right before your eyes. It's like watching an idea form in your head. You're like, there it is.
And I know.
It's astounding to me. I mean, I read these things all the time in the paper. And I mean, I'm not a young man anymore, but I guess that's one of the gifts of being not a young man, is that you get to see these things happen. But like the idea of white American nationalism, I just don't, it would have been inconceivable to me 20 years ago that there was such a thing.
No, it's absolutely, true. And you know, the book was long enough in the making that it was written when nationalism played a slightly different role in American life or in the life of the West. But of course, you know, in the last couple of years, there's sort of a clear redefinition of the significance of nationalism in our life and the way many of us see nationalism's future, right? I think many of, you know, Gen X, of the people of the generations, either Gen X or baby boomers, would definitely think that the general political trajectory moves away from nation states towards greater unions, and in this regard would read Cohn's work as sort of a little bit obvious, stating the obvious.
Yeah.
You know, you look at it 2016, it doesn't look quite like that. So maybe I don't want to put the question, but I'm wondering if maybe that is a good point to talk about what we can learn from him and his legacy,
let's do that.
And the way he was remembered, and the way that at least I think he could be remembered, what we can learn from him.
Yeah, well, I mentioned at the beginning there's a review that you sent me, and at the end of this review, the reviewer, whom shall not be mentioned, says some rather unkind things about Cohn.
It's a positive review.
It's a very positive, it says it's a great book, but right at the end it has this tremendous disjuncture, it just turns. And it says, it is in the end impossible to see what Cohn has to contribute to ongoing reconsiderations of Zionism that we aren't regularly hearing from other uncompromising opponents of ethnic nationalism and defenders of the wholly impractical idea of a binational Jewish Arab state. Wow.
No, you know, I think I addressed in the book some of those questions, because of course when you write a biography you also want to address the question of how the person is received in his lifetime and afterwards. And I feel that one of the greater challenges that I had to deal with is the question of Cohn's legacy. And I think there's so much sort of cherry picking in how Cohn is remembered and how Cohn is forgotten, because I think the reviewer's point was, it's time we forget this guy, right?
Yeah, it is. So, that is the point.
So I think, you know, there's, on the one hand, you know, there's largely a consensus about his importance as a pioneer of the academic study of nationalism. But I think it was Cohn's political commitments that have determined and polarized the manner in which his intellectual and ethical legacy is presented. And the key moments in this regard are his defiance of political Zionism. We talked about it a lot.
Right.
His defiance of political Zionism, and later of the State of Israel, because he doesn't let go also after 48, indeed throughout his life. And on the other hand, his Cold War service on behalf of soft power used by the U.S. and NATO.
Uh-huh.
Now, both of these actions attracted both admirers as well as detractors. You know, so you have one camp then that saw his theory of nationalism as nothing more than apology of colonialism, that would be Soviet scholars of nationalism at the time, or as self-congratulatory Western demonization of Eastern European nationalism, that is sort of more versions of the New Left. Another camp, however, would celebrate him as a model, almost sort of Cassandra-like prophet of progressive self-critique. Those would be people who are critics of Zionism or State of Israel, and see in him a man who spoke, say, truth to power. And it is for these reasons that people wanted to either remember him or forget him. I think those are the two crucial moments. Now, needless to say, each of these camps is familiar only with one aspect of Cohn, and the portrait that I've presented is, I hope, somewhat fuller one, containing inattentions and also theoretical irresolvability. And I think it is more indicative of the struggle that we all have in coming to terms, not only with our nationalism or the nationalism of the other, but with nationalism as such. Many of us may want to wish it away, but the fact is that the last couple of years have once again redefined the significance and role of nationalism in much of the world, and perhaps most tangibly in the West. So, you know,
well, I think that's the story of his, you know, if there's a takeaway, and you don't want Haynes to simplify things like this, but I think he wanted to wish away nationalism his whole life, and he was hoping that it would just go away. But every place he went, it was just there, and it emerged right in forms that he hadn't anticipated. And Lord knows, as we just said, that's happened in our, that's happened in the last 10 years in the United States. Yeah. Who anticipated this? I didn't.
Right. No. I mean, the magnitude of events, like, you know, the reaction to the great debt, the Greek debt crisis, the
right
European
yeah
reaction to the refugee crisis, the Brexit vote, the Trump campaign.
Nobody would anticipate these things.
I have a few quotes that I want to sort of mention in this regard.
Do that.
Shortly before leaving office, President Obama warned, and I quote, against the rise of the crude sort of nationalism or ethnic identity or tribalism that is built around an us and a them. And French President Emmanuel Macron used very similar juxtaposition in presenting himself, quote, as the president of the patriots against the threat of nationalists. And just last week, you know, Republican Senator John McCain warned against the rise of, again, half-baked spurious nationalism. And just a week ago, President George W. Bush warned against the resurgent ethno-nationalism and stated, and I quote again, we've seen nationalism distorted into nativism, forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America, and added, our identity as a nation, unlike many other nations, is not determined by geography or ethnicity, by soil or blood. And with this, of course, he related to Charlottesville. I mean, I think all of those statements indicate to me not just a return to Cohn's understanding of nationalism, but to the very challenges and anxieties that generated his lifelong struggle with nationalism.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, the positive side of this is that we have people like Cohen to remind us of these things. That, you know, the challenging part is that this is not just going to go away. It just comes back like a bad penny. You know, it just does not go away. And you really have to, you know, wishing it away in some theoretical sense by calling it an imagined community or something, that just isn't going to work. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's going to always come back. And and his life is sort of a testament to that. I loved your book. I thought it was great. And I think that more people should read about this guy. What is it? Let me ask you this. I know we're well over time, but does anybody remember Hans Cohen in Israel today? Is there a Hans Cohen Institute or a Hans Cohen, I don't know, chair of history, or is there anything that is, you know?
Not really. I would not say that, you know, Hans Cohen is necessarily seen in very negative light in Israel nowadays. I think the academic discourse has moved past that. So there are definitely scholars, and definitely not the only Israeli who's interested in Hans Cohen and the, you know, the vistas that he opens to the history of Israel, or the history of Zionism. But definitely there isn't any Hans Cohen Institute in Israel. He himself, of course, you know, never made his peace with Israel, even though much of his family was there. Many of his closest friends remained there, but he would never even set foot on Israel's soil after 1934. And this is a man who visited,
he traveled.
1950s, Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and all of the entire region, but he would definitely not go to Israel. So obviously there is both a resentment of Israel in him that is both grounded in biography and in political ideology. There is a growing interest in Cohn's writing in, I would say, the last 10 years, you know, around the world. There was a republication of the idea of nationalism, I think more than half a century after it was originally published. But who knows? Maybe now the new calamities that history...
Yeah, I don't know.
Renaissance of Hans Kohn scholarship.
Well, let me ask you the traditional final question. We're well over time, but this is too interesting, and I could talk about this forever. Adi, what are you working on now? What is your next project or current project?
All right, I will be really brief regarding this. I am working now on German right-wing interwar intellectuals who call themselves the conservative revolutionaries. And specifically, I'm looking at five different groups of scholars who identified as conservative revolutionaries. I'm looking at the ways in which they theorized Jewish difference, what they called Jewish difference, how the Jews are different. And I think there was a certain lesson that they wanted to draw from the Jewish sense of distinctiveness into the German settings, you know, all hostilities and animosities aside. So that is it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds good. And we'll have you on the show when it's done. Okay.
Thanks so much, Marshall.
Okay. Well, let me say we've been talking to Adi Gordon today about his terrific book, Toward Nationalism's End, an intellectual biography of the great Hans Kohn. So Adi, let me thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Marshall.
And let me say thank you to everyone who listens to this podcast. My name is Marshall Poe, and I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and we really appreciate you listening to all of our podcasts and look forward to publishing more of them for you. So I hope you have a great week.